You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California. And our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will accompany our Tuesday night Zoom gatherings, and we hope that they form you, encourage you, and maybe even make you laugh, and that they would be a source of King Jesus guiding you through this time. So, have you ever had an embarrassing moment? Like, not something embarrassing happened to you, but a moment you were embarrassed by, like, something in your own character that you really hate thinking about, you really wish never happened, and you wish you could just erase it from history. Well, to be honest, that's sort of how I feel about the topic we're bringing up today on the podcast. The topic is women in ministry or women's role in the church. And man, some of the texts in the New Testament on their face are embarrassing to me. Every time I read them, I just wince a little bit. And I sort of just wish that they weren't there, but they are. So we got to talk about them. And if you feel similarly at all, welcome to the podcast for you, my friend. We have a special guest today. Steve Luxa is with us, the senior pastor at FBC, and he has recently led FBC through a transition in our understanding of women's roles in ministry, and so obviously has looked at these texts and wrestled with them, and he's coming on the show today to talk about what that wrestling looked like. And so we'll be jumping around in our Bibles quite a bit, and it's an awesome conversation, especially if you've ever wondered how people make sense of the scriptures. What it looks like to come to a conviction when there's different viewpoints. It's both exactly what you think it'd be and also maybe more surprising and more complex than you might have thought it would be. And then, like I said, Steve recently led our church through a pretty significant change in this area. And so I ask him some questions about what that was like. And we get pretty honest about the hard stuff, the areas he and I disagreed, what was going through his mind and his heart, and even what he would do differently with some hindsight. It's a pretty rare kind of conversation as far as I'm concerned, and one I'm excited for you to listen to. And, you know, if all you want is pure Bible stuff, then you can probably stop about halfway through this podcast. But if you want to hear what it looks like and feels like to enact theology in real time, then listen to the whole thing. And as always, enjoy the podcast. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Your Pod and Your Staff. We are halfway through winter quarter, which means that we are halfway through this year, which feels pretty remarkable. And it's as good a time as ever to have a very, very special guest on our show. I am not alone this morning. I'm actually joined by Steve Luxa. Steve, what's going on?
Hey, thanks for having me. I love College Life, and I think this is the first time I've been able to speak at College Life. I've been here 5 years, so it's great to be here. I'm so glad that you guys have invited me in, and it's fun to be here.
Yeah, I remember Neil said one time, he's like, you should just get the person to speak that you want to speak. So just even if you don't think they're going to, you should ask them. And I feel like I've adopted that advice for other people, but for some reason I always think about how the senior pastor must have so much going on that it always just felt like a non-starter. And so that's user error on my part when I have you on. So this is long overdue.
Well, Dan said the same thing. So Dan didn't invite me either, but you know, I loved dropping in on the Tuesday nights and I loved talking with students, and I love talking with students on Sunday morning. So, you know, I'm just glad I get to be a part of the thing now, right?
Yeah, you are a champion of College Life, which I've always appreciated. Sitting in my office, to know that you love the ministry is a joy. Because I got to tell you, I know that you look at the financials more than most other people on staff, and College Life's probably not bringing in the dough. We're spending it more than we're bringing it in. So it's a ministry of love for the church.
Well, we were all college students once, and so we all need to be loved on so we can be unleashed in this world for the kingdom. And so, you know, my great hope and dream is that, you know, we give every college student a great church experience, not just a ministry experience, but a church experience. So they go out and they love the local church. They go out and serve the church, and they can kind of, you know that they've received from the church so that when they go out and serve the church, they can do the same for the next generation and raise up a new generation of people who love Jesus. So it's actually my joy and gift.
Yeah, it's like you're taking our hopes, our missions, and just taking it and putting it in your own lips. God, I love the idea of our students learning to love the local church, because sometimes it's not easy to love, but it's a little easier to love when there's a senior pastor who cares deeply. So thanks for modeling that.
Well, and it may be, I totally agree. It can be hard to love the local church because it's called the Bride of Christ, and sometimes it can feel like Bridezilla. You know, I mean, maybe that's not PC to say, but it can.
No, that's we've said worse. You know, it feels a little strange though, because you know, I am the sort of arbitrary leader of this little podcast, but you're my boss man. You know, you're the one who pays my check. So thank you, by the way, for paying me. I really appreciate that.
Good investment.
Able to buy a house, able to purchase a car. So we should just put your name, etch your name into those things.
Well, I do. Half property. I do want to drive your Outback sometimes. So we need to haul some stuff around.
But I was thinking about how this must be a little bit like what Jimmy Kimmel might feel like if he interviews David Letterman on his show. It's like, whoa, we should be in different seats. this isn't how this is supposed to be. You're the one that's supposed to be leading the show. So I thought I was going to suggest we should switch offices just to make sure it was going to feel normal for us. but I feel pretty comfortable in my blanketed podcast studio here. But,
yeah, I like sitting in my chair too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We got a lot to talk about, and I'm excited to talk about it. You know, what we're doing right now and in this conversation and sort of for the rest of the quarter is we're having some what I think are pretty important conversations. And we are sort of looking at the epistles in a sort of more holistic sense. And, you know, last quarter we talked about them individually. It's really helpful to have the distinctives of each one in our mind. But also, you know, there's some repeated themes or there's some other things that come up over and over and again that we want to talk about and hopefully model the way that we live for Jesus in the way that these early Christians were living for Jesus. But there's also things that are happening in our world as we try to live for Jesus that we have questions about. And we kind of want to know, hey, does the first go around of trying to live for Jesus in a new context, which, you know, we've talked about being, this is what the epistles are. The epistles are the people of God trying to figure out what does it mean to take these truths and these ideas and this story into a new context. Now it's no longer just an Israel story. Now it's a Jew Gentile. Now it's a story for all nations. And we got to figure out how to do this well. And so anyway, all that to say, there's questions that we might have about our world that we want to ask the epistles. And you know, we sort of pitched this series as one of themes, and so I kind of imagined it as a sort of magnifying glass on one of the categories that we went through for the individual epistles. And I don't know if you had listened to much of our podcast, but we broke down the individual epistles in these different categories, and one of them was I themed a theme, which was just obviously looking at a theme of a particular epistle. One was quick question, which is modeled after Stanford's unique pronunciation of question and Christian. And just when it's something seemed puzzling or whatnot, and there were some others, but one of them was, hey, can I have an eraser? and these were for the text that just felt like, wow, if I was writing these, if I was given the permission to write the biblical text, which I don't have, but if, you know, in that thought experiment, if I had the opportunity, I would not have included this or I would not have said it that way. Yeah. And so I sort of see this particular conversation as zooming in on that category, but on a sort of meta sense. You know, as we read through the epistles for last quarter, you know, we came across these moments that Paul is talking about women in the church, women in ministry, and just honestly, it just seems so regressive. Is there anything you want to say before we get going? I'd love to sort of just paint the picture of why I'm excited to talk about this because of why it feels so uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, and many times the Bible is going to speak against us, right? I mean, I think we do want to have an eraser, and we're not the first to believe this. We're not the only people who encounter the scriptures and want to do that, right? Because the Bible actually speaks at some level and in some ways against every person in any culture. That's just the way it is. And instead of shrinking back from that and thinking God to be a monster, I think we should actually be encouraged by that. And here's what I mean, is that if the Bible didn't push against us, if God didn't push against us, we wouldn't have a sense that we actually have a relationship with him. Because otherwise, it's just God just becomes the perfection of what we already think. And so if we really live in a relationship with God, in any relationship, a relationship, they're going to affirm us and they're going to confront us because of their love for us, right? I mean, when we're in marriage, when we're in friendships, we know this dynamic of people speaking against us, not because they hate us, but because they love us. And and if the scriptures were just to affirm us and affirm what we think all the time, then we would have a relationship with a goldfish, not a divine being. You know,
goldfish. Yeah. So you're a fan of fish. That might not be so bad for you.
Yeah, there we go. So I think it actually should reassure us when we come across uncomfortable things. Instead of shrinking back, we should be encouraged that it's like, hey, we've encountered a God here, not just a figment of my imagination or a figment of the best of my imagination. So for what it's worth.
Yeah, that's something we've said in college life over the years, is that if there's nothing in your worldview that you sort of wish wasn't there, or that if there's nothing in your worldview that you don't like believing, then you don't really believe anything. You know, you just believe what you tend to think. It's just wish fulfillment is what we called it, you know?
Exactly.
And so I totally agree with that. It doesn't always make the individual uncomforts and discomforts easier, but on a meta level, it's like, okay, I'm doing real work with something real. It's not just me. You know, it's not just what I could come up with if I was writing down the rules of the universe. It's like I'm pushing up against something real, which is, I agree with you, on a meta level can be reassuring.
And I understand how at a smaller level, at a micro level, it's like it really bugs us. It's a pebble in our shoe. But if we stand back and think of it, it's like, okay, actually, here is God. He has sent Jesus to die for me. I am safe with what he has to say to me. Because it may not be the answer I have immediately, but maybe there are deeper depths to plumb, and maybe I don't understand everything I should understand. Mm-hmm. But it gives us a kind of a safety net to ask really awkward, uncomfortable questions and really probe the scriptures for those answers. I mean, I hope does that make sense? I mean, it's more that I want us to sense that this is a safety net that we have, not a big scary monster that's going to come after us and make us do stuff that we shouldn't be doing. Right?
Right, right, right. No, I think it does
make
sense.
Or that would destroy us.
Yeah. And I would love to just paint, you know, again, get a little bit more narrow and think about, I guess, at least what I experience when I come across some of the texts that we're going to talk about today. And what I imagine either college students are feeling or just people in the modern world are feeling is that, you know, if you're a Christian and you want to know and you want to love the scriptures, then you come across passages that we're going to see today where it seems like Paul is saying – I mean, it very much seems like Paul is saying that women categorically, just women categorically, are not permitted to teach or lead in church in the same way. There's talk of being silent in church. There's talk of needing to wear appropriate dress kind of in church. Yeah. That all feels limiting and all feels really, really regressive, if we're being honest, especially when we're thinking about it in terms of our world. And so it just sort of offends in every way of how we think the world ought to work, the equality we see in men and women, the equal gifting we see in men and women. And so it feels like we're sort of thrust into this really, really terrible decision where either we're going to take the Bible seriously and have to believe something that sort of just feels wrong. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking autobiographically. Yeah. I'm sure maybe other people don't think it feels wrong. But just to me, it's just – it feels wrong. It feels like this does not line up with experience. This does not line up with what I see in other parts of the scriptures. This just doesn't feel like it fits. And I feel like it's going to hurt the church's witness, because like, who wants to be the organization that's knowingly limiting women? I don't want to be a part of that. You know, it's like I'm not excited about signing up for that kind of organization. Or, you know, we go with this, what just feels true to us, what feels right, what feels like the way it ought to be, which is, you know, we see equal gifting in men and women. We think this just feels like it makes sense. And we sort of risk being like not taking the text very seriously, which feels a little bit like a slippery slope. And, you know, we want to take the scripture seriously. And so we're sort of put into this really, really troubling sort of decision it seems like we have to make, is like, are we going to take the text seriously and be pretty regressive, or are we going to really go with what feels like our gut and then open ourselves up to not taking the scriptures very seriously? And so what I've asked you to do is take us through some of these texts. And it should be noted, like one of the main reasons that we have you on this podcast, not just because you're the senior pastor, but you're also a senior pastor who led a church through a transition from not having women be able to be pastors and preach into now women being able to be pastors and preach at FBC. And so you've done a lot of the heavy lifting and obviously cared enough about this to move a big boat in a different direction. So thanks for being on.
But I
just think setting the table for the conversation, that's why it's uncomfortable, because it feels like an impossible choice between two hard things.
And always when there is this binary decision-making, right? When it's an either or, sometimes in the scripture, there's a completely third option that we've never thought about, right? I mean, in this case, it's like, do I choose equality and believe everyone's made in God's image? Or do I choose these very clear, definitive statements and texts and commands.
Right.
You know, because one feels right, the other one feels harsh. And then we end up using either one of them as a kind of an emotional sledgehammer against the other side. Right. I mean, I'm going to dig my heels in because I can't do. But I think there's actually a different way. I think that there is a way forward. So let's just name the elephant in the room here, and let's go to these texts.
Yeah, let's dive into the text.
Yeah, the first one is in 1 Corinthians 14, verses 33 to 35. And Paul's talking about the church in chapters 12 to 14. That's really where he's kind of giving directions about the worship services and how they're actually happening and the chaos that was ensuing. And he wants to bring order. He wants to bring a kind of a clarity of direction of what those services should look like, you know. And so in part of that, he says this. He says, as in all the churches of the saints, so every church everywhere, the women should keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but should be in submission, as the law also says. As if it's not bad enough that he's saying it, also the law is saying this, right?
Right.
If there is anything they desire to learn, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is shameful, shameful for a woman to speak in church. Yikes. I mean, like,
yeah, no, that's not good. That doesn't feel good.
I mean, it's not enough to just say, you know, women should be silent. Let me pile on here kind of a thing, right? Not permitted to speak, not should be in submission. You know, the law also says that. So in multiple ways, you kind of feel the sledgehammer of this verse and the real harshness of this. And again, you know, to your point, how is this not repressive? Well, hold on to that question, right? The other big one is in 1 Timothy 2, right? 1 Timothy 2, 12 to 15, where he's talking about just the operation of the church. He's talking about men and women. And he says this, he says, I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet. Okay, a little bit less harsh there, right? Quiet, not silent. All right. But then he goes into his reasoning. He says, for Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet she will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith and love and holiness with self-control. So it's kind of that 50s mentality of the woman, right? Barefoot and pregnant and, you know, second-class citizen, can't speak, can't say anything. And again, how is this not sexist? How is this not oppressive? And they do, they make us feel like we have to recoil from these kind of texts. But I really think that what we have to do is, instead of zooming in on these really definitive statements, we actually have to see the context in which they were said. And what I mean by that is we need to understand the greater story of the church that's actually going on. And instead of zooming in on these particular texts, we need to kind of widen our camera lens beyond the greater restrictive verses to the greater storylines of the New Testament and what actually happened in the early church and how women were actually involved in the early church.
Yeah.
Because we get pictures of this all over the place in the scriptures. They don't tend to be the verses that we like dwell on in our quiet times, or, you know, that we run across when we're reading and think, oh, these are so rich, I just want to sit here and bathe, right? I mean, they're not those kind of verses. So first off, we get to Acts chapter 2, when the church is actually birthed and launched at Pentecost, when the Spirit comes down and people are asking, well, what is going on here? What is happening? Mm-hmm. And Peter, he gives this explanation of the church. How they were to understand this event. And primary to his explanation was actually to go back to the Old Testament scriptures and quote a prophet by the name of Joel. And he says this in verses 16 through 18. He says, but this is what was uttered through the prophet Joel. And in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. And your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. And your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Even on my male servants and female servants in those days, I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy. Now, this is utterly remarkable that Peter even says this, because most rabbis believe that the Spirit had stopped speaking in the Old Testament with Malachi. That would have been 400 years before this point, and that there was no message from God. But with the coming of Christ, Peter's declaring here that the Spirit has come in his first sermon, And the key evidence of the Spirit's presence, the key evidence of Jesus' rule and reign on this planet is prophecy come through men and women.
That's really interesting, actually. Yeah, that's really interesting.
I think it's fascinating. I love this stuff. I mean, when we think of prophecy, we tend to think of like
future telling.
Yeah, like fortune telling, right? Right. We're gonna tell you what's gonna be happening. But if you look back at how prophecy actually functioned in the Old Testament, it is predictive. It is foretelling. But it's the vast majority of it is actually forthtelling, in that it is declaring God's will. The prophet would declare God's will and apply God's will to the modern day, right? So, and sometimes it was spontaneous, like Elijah and Elisha that we read about in 1 and 2 Kings. And other times it was prepared, and so prepared that these prophets would write it down, like Isaiah and Jeremiah. Mm-hmm. And now in the New Testament, we don't have a whole lot of examples of prophecy. I mean, there's a couple of them. But basically, this term for prophecy, as was understood in the New Testament, is that it was understood as spontaneous or prepared messages where a speaker understood it to be a message from God. And from everything I can gather, from scholarship done and kind of broader reading, it sounds an awful lot like what we call preaching today.
Yeah, but I was going to say, it seems like.
Yeah, it's the declaration of God's will and the applying of God's will for a specific situation, a specific time, and moving forward. And that's significant because think about it. Peter is saying the mark of the Spirit on the church is not just that men would be declaring these messages from God, but also women, and not just the rich and the intelligent and the important, but also the servants and those who others would look down on, that everyone in the church would be kind of this mouthpiece for God. That's significant.
Yeah. So if you were to build your whole theology of women in ministry on Acts 2, you would probably be left with the conclusion that both men and women are going to be speaking the word of God, are going to be preparing sermon type things, to put it in sort of modern parlance, like they're both going to be doing that. If you were to just have Acts 2.
Yeah. Right? And I think you'd say it even stronger than that. You'd say to do otherwise would mean to betray, would show less than the Spirit, would show less than Jesus actually being king.
Yeah. I mean, that's great. That's well said. Okay. That's actually exciting. What's another, you said that there was multiple sort of New Testament.
Yeah.
Backdrop verses.
Yeah. Now that's just when the church was born. We're going to go to another one in Romans 16, where Paul kind of name drops.
Romans 16. Yes. No one's favorite chapter of Romans.
Right.
It's when everyone stops reading Romans.
Everyone stops reading. But he lists all these names. And I know we just breeze past these because we don't recognize the names. It doesn't seem important. He's communicating information that it does not feel all that relevant to us. But to understand this backdrop of women in ministry, this is actually a remarkable chapter. You get to verse 1, for instance, in chapter 16. And Paul, he says, I commend to you our sister Phoebe, the servant of the church in Cenchrea, that you may welcome her in the Lord in a way worthy of the saints and help her in whatever she may need from you. For she has been a patron of many and of myself as well. Yeah. So very significant here. Verse 1, she says that she is a servant. That translation actually does not do justice to what actually is going on there, I think. She's called a diakonos of the church in Greek. And so if you actually look I believe in the footnotes of the ESV, it actually says could be translated as deacon or deaconess. It means that than she was just helpful. It probably means she was a deaconess of the church where she led and she shepherded in practical care for people who needed it. And maybe you're saying, okay, Steve, you're kind of stretching it here. But if he didn't mean this, he actually had other words that were available to him. If he just wanted to say she was helpful or stuff like that, there were other Greek words that he could have used. And he didn't need to drop this qualifier in of the church. He could have changed it, you know, to the church or at the church or in the church. But saying of the church like this actually defines it as kind of an office. And staking her out as an office of the church.
Yeah.
Right?
You know what's interesting? I know that Wright, N.T. Wright, has made mention of this, and he acknowledges that it's sort of historical imagination. You know, it's like you can't know this for sure. Yeah. But he's like, you know, the system for taking these letters to the different churches was that, you know, Paul would write it. Paul and whoever was piecing it together would write it, and then someone would deliver it.
Yeah.
You know, and often that person's named, and you know, it seems like he's saying, "I commend to you our sister Phoebe."
Yeah.
It seems to make sense. Like, this is Phoebe. You know, yeah. Phoebe's the one that took it and has now read Romans to the churches, which Romans is like one of the most important pieces of literature in the whole entire universe,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And perhaps Phoebe, a woman, was the first to read it. And if you're reading it, you're preaching it. I mean, it's yeah. like, it's maybe not exactly your words, but
right.
you're the mouthpiece of this
right.
unbelievable text,
right.
right? I mean, that's significant.
You're the steward of it, right?
Yeah.
Incredibly
right.
significant. And Peter, it even goes deeper than that, because this idea of being a servant of the church, if you zoom out and just sort of look at how Paul uses this sort of term, not just as a deaconess of the church, but it also is telling, because it can be quite possibly she was responsible for the word, because this term is actually used in other places like this, in like Ephesians 3:7 or Colossians 1:7 or 1 Timothy 4:6. A servant of the church was one who is responsible to minister in the church.
Yeah, right.
And bringing the word. This is not a generic kind of title and throwaway term. This is a heavy, weighty title. An office of the church, quite possibly responsible for the word within the church. Mm-hmm. So this is a pretty exalted kind of deal that he's putting on with Phoebe here.
So again, if you didn't have the restrictive texts,
yeah.
and you had Acts 2 and you had Romans 16,
yeah.
you'd probably come to a conclusion that women are going to be instrumental in teaching the people of God.
Yeah.
You know? And just like you said, to do otherwise would be to be unfaithful.
Yeah. Well, and not just teach, but also lead. Right?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
So this is significant. And then if that's not enough, in verse 7, if you go down there, and we don't recognize these names because they're kind of foreign to us, but in verse 7, he says, "Greet Andronicus and Junia, my kinsmen and my fellow prisoners. They are well known to the apostles, and they were in Christ before me." Now, what's not amazing and apparent is that Junia is a woman, probably, most likely a woman, and she's a fellow prisoner with Paul. She came to Christ before Paul, he says here, and she's known to the apostles. And again, that translation does not do this justice. It says literally that they were well known among the apostles, that Paul is saying she is counted in the company of apostles. Now, that's not to say she's one of the, you know, the 12 apostles who led the whole church, that Jesus commissioned directly, but she's one who functioned like an apostle. She could be counted right. as someone who is an apostle. And the apostles were ones who started new ministries. They planted churches. Maybe Junia, quite possibly this, Junia is a missionary who's been sent mm-hmm. out with the word, right? So this again is significant. She's counted in the company of apostles, counted as one of them, because they're known among the apostles, all right?
Yeah, that's super interesting. You know, you're mentioning she wasn't one of the 12 apostles. Have you ever heard people say if God wanted women to be leading the church, he would have had a woman as one of the disciples?
Yeah, I've heard often those are arguments used to keep the restrictive texts and underscore. And I get that. I understand that. But I think if we were to be honest with it, could we envision Jesus actually having a woman disciple? It was never done in that day. It would be breaking all categories. It would actually be pretty scandalous for what he did. What Jesus did do actually was elevate women in ways that were already scandalous without, you know, like Mary and Martha, like exalting, giving them a place of learning, which did not happen in the first century. And second of all, it was pretty well known that he had a group of women. I believe it's in Luke, that followed him around as much as disciples and supported the ministry, that he brought women as close as he possibly could without undue scandal. Because if it had been too scandalized, he wouldn't have been able to do what he was able to do and have kind of the leverage that he did as a rabbi. Rabbis did not have other women following them around. They had wives, but not other women.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it is in Luke. I think it's like Luke 8.
Yeah.
Where there's a group of women in his cohort and he allows them to sort of touch him for healing, you know, which was sort of scandalous. And then there's obviously the sort of famous stories of like, the women are the one telling the story of his resurrection. You know, this is the goodest of good news, right? That, that Jesus risen from the dead, and it's through the mouthpiece of a woman teaching these, and maybe I'm getting careless with the language, but like giving these men this revelation. It's interesting when you zoom out, like just like you said, when you zoom out from the restrictive text, a picture is painted of women in the church that feels different than the restrictive text. But do you have any more examples of that?
So this is one I would say that has been very significant for me, and it's a crazy text. It really is. It's the text where you read, and Paul is getting all wrapped up in head coverings and hair and length and stuff like that. But let me just zoom in on 1 Corinthians 11 verses 4 and 5.
Yeah, this is not a easy one.
No.
This is a text you're like, gosh, this feels so like, do I believe this? Like, is this the same?
Yeah, it's like,
is this
okay.
The same worldview? Yeah.
Obviously, I don't understand a whole lot, but getting into the details of this text is beautiful. Let me read these verses and then I'll try to unpack, I think, what he's driving at. So Paul says this. He says, every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. So that's just craziness, right? I mean, what is going on here?
Yeah.
I think what Paul is doing here is he's the hair, the head covering, those were all signs of sexuality actually in the first century. And he wanted men and women, husbands and wives, to communicate their sexual fidelity in line with the scriptures. For a woman to have her head covered, for a man to have short hair meant that he was honoring God. That's why they got the yarmulkes, for the Jewish people wear the yarmulkes. For women to have their heads shaved, it communicated sexual looseness in that culture. And so Paul is saying, I don't want you guys to do that. You have freedom in Christ, yes, but you're using this freedom in ways that are confusing to one another and confusing to the culture. And so he's saying, what I want you to do is I want you to, women, I want you to cover your heads and I want you to have long hair. Guys, I want you to have short hair and I don't want you to be covering your heads. And so he's talking about how he wants them to dress in the service when they are praying and prophesying. This is a correction from Paul in the manner of dress that they had and what kind of signals that they were sending that would not be confusing. Not that women were praying and prophesying publicly in a service. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. What you're saying is we often hear these texts as a restriction on women to teach and to lead, I guess. But what you're saying is this whole head covering thing, it's more about, hey, how are you just appearing to the watching world? How is the watching world seeing you? If you are adopting these sort of well-known signs of promiscuity and sexual looseness, like you're just not, we are not going to be taken seriously. And this is not good. And you know what? I actually, one thing that stuck out to me a lot when we were going through the individual epistles, actually mostly in Timothy, which is not what we're reading right now, but was one of the restrictive verses, is how much Paul seemed to care about what the world thought of them. You know, he talked about leading a peaceful and quiet life and dignified in every way. He teaches them not to quarrel, you know, for women to be modest, for men to be not, you know, non-quarrelsome. He just seems to care a lot about like, what does the church look like to people? Which feels very important for this conversation. Yeah. And how important to the conversation, I'm not quite sure, but it definitely feels important to the conversation that he is not just interested in telling the Corinthians, like, this is a systematic theology of men and women, you know? He seems to be saying, like, you are living in a particular context in a particular time, and I'm going to help you think through what it looks like to live faithfully to Jesus in Corinth in this time. And I got to tell you, if you're just going to like frivolously just like not care what people think about like your sexual behavior, you know, we want to live in a different way. We want to show that we're a different kind of humanity. Like this is counter to our message.
Yeah, Peter, I think you're right. I think part of what he's doing in these texts is that sometimes we get so caught up in like the head coverings and the hair. It's like, well, what does all that mean? And we miss the bigger point that Paul is actually saying, yeah, I want you to pray and prophesy, but I want you to do it in a way that doesn't hinder the gospel, doesn't hinder people being able to hear from God, because what you're doing is confusing and offensive, right? I think at some level he's saying, you know, I want the gospel to be the only kind of thing that they have to object to. I want Jesus to be the only one they have to object to, not how you are acting, what you are dressed like, and the like. Does that make sense? Is that what you're kind of getting at?
Yeah, totally, totally. And I like that is so compelling to me, but it's just like I'm aware that right now what we've done is just talked about everything other than like the texts that were in question, right? And yet it all sort of makes sense, but what we're doing is I love it, but it's essentially saying, okay, there's these restrictive texts and they seem really, really hard. Yeah. And so we're saying, okay, if we zoom out and we look at a bigger picture, there's a way of at least softening the blow, but maybe it produces the tension a little bit. If I could retrace the tension that I played earlier, it's almost like, it's not just like, hey, I want the two choices before me are choice number one, right. I'm going to follow the scriptures and be regressive socially, or I'm going to be progressive socially and just disregard the scriptures. Now it's like, well, which part of the scriptures am I going to favor? You know, it's like, am I going to favor this New Testament stuff where it's like, it seems so clear that women are going to be teaching, women are going to be leading. And, you know, obviously there's the Galatians 3:28, which we talked about with Rick last week. There's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male or female, you know, and it's saying all are equal in the kingdom, which seems like I don't think it's a smoking gun, but it certainly fits into that sort of reading of all these texts. So it's either, am I going to believe all these, like the things you just talked about, Acts and this Corinthians 11 one and the stuff about Phoebe, or am I going to believe these really two main restrictive texts? What's going to be the thing that's going to guide my thinking on women in ministry? And that's hard.
Yeah, I mean— it's very difficult because it feels like I have to choose. Mm-hmm. But I think what it does is we can say, okay, are these restrictive texts going to trump these other texts? And there's some who've done that, right? There's others who say, no, I'm going to take the other texts, like these ones from Acts and these ones from the ones that I've been talking about, and we're going to use that and have that trump the other ones.
Right.
And I think the better one is to say, you know, this is a mosaic of the early church and how it actually functioned. It's not a monolithic kind of a multicultural, multinational family. Mm-hmm. This is a complex, relationally diverse sort of system. And so if we appreciate kind of the whole backdrop, I think it actually helps us to put into context like what is happening in this restrictive text.
Yeah.
It doesn't lessen the blow. It helps us to appreciate what Paul is actually saying in these texts, I think.
Yeah. And so would you say that he's saying in these texts is related to sort of the watching world and how maybe living into the full equality that is allowed in the family of God would be so counterproductive in these particular cultures that it would almost be, it's like, hey, let's be a little pragmatic about this. We have more freedom allowed to us than I'm going to tell you to exercise.
How about we just get into the
restrictive text? Yeah. I was going to say, do you have some stuff that you can lead us through for the restrictives?
Yeah. So like in 1 Corinthians 14, when we hear, you know, just this bludgeoning of women to, you know, stay silent, not talk and things like that. Well, we just read in 1 Corinthians 11, that silence can't be absolute because he's telling women to pray and prophesy in a specific way. And that involves not being silent. And even if you go just before that passage in 1 Corinthians 14, if you jump up to verse 26, he says, brothers, and that term, brothers and sisters, it's men and women in the church, he commands them to bring their verbal contributions in an orderly way, because the sense that we get from Corinthians is that it was just a chaotic environment that was going on with, you know, everyone's talking over one another and jumping in and you know, some prophecy and then some tongues and just kind of all kinds of craziness. And he's trying to get them to be orderly so it could be understood by the people who are there and understood by the people who would be dropping in. So I tend to think the scholars are right here, that they've concluded that there was some disruptive chatter that was happening, and he's addressing the chaos that was going on in this church and in the worship services and giving prescriptions to correct it. And so, you know, we can well imagine what these, you know, why the women were so enthusiastic, you know, that there was these new educational opportunities that there was not widely available to most women in that day. And they get in these educational opportunities in the worship services and they are charged by it. And so they're being disorderly about it. Or they just were overly talkative or anxious. You know, they were the person in the small group who just kept talking and talking and talking over everyone because they were just so encouraged by it. But, you know, this is probably Paul just calling for an end to what some of was the disruptive chatter to what was supposed to be going on in this worship service, and just solved it by saying, you know, go home and process this actually with your husband.
So the argument is that for some reason, women are doing this more than men.
Yeah,
because that doesn't seem totally plausible to me. But I could see it being in every other arena, women are not allowed to participate, are not allowed to be learned like their husbands, and now they're in an environment where they can.
Yeah,
and so maybe there is some extra excitement. Yeah, that is kind of interesting. It feels like any and all sort of generalizations we seem so allergic to, you know. Yeah. But also, if you're Paul, it's tough to be more specific sometimes. That's what's so hard about this. It's like we have to think about what it meant then and try to put our imagination glasses on of what it would have sounded like to these people. And yet we always have our cultural lens on.
Well, in 1 Corinthians, again, this is a church that took their liberties and they went too far with them. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the women. The women were maybe doing it in this way because they're in a patriarchal culture. Now they're able to contribute and add, and they might have jumped in with both feet. But listen, there's equal opportunity offenders here, because in the passage we just talked about in 1 Corinthians 11, he's correcting the men who were taking same liberties about how they were dressing and sending off the wrong sexual signals. If you go further in 1 Corinthians, further on, you know, men were taking liberties sexually that Paul was like, stop it, right? I mean, so this was, I think the Corinthian church, they were trying to live out the freedom in Christ and express it in ways that kind of unshackled them from whatever restrictions they had. And Paul is trying to say, you know, no, some of those restrictions, we want to be culturally appropriate so that people don't get the wrong signals.
Yeah.
And we want to do it in a way that's orderly. I think that's what Paul's getting at. And I don't think this is a generalization about women. I think he's just saying, let's not interrupt each other.
Yeah.
Don't interrupt. This is a solution for the interruption that was happening, not about women being second-class citizens, because he actually wants women to learn, which was a radical idea even in the first century.
Yeah. Right?
He's not saying to shut their ears. He's saying learn.
Right.
But let's learn appropriately. Let's not talk over people and inhibit their ability to do that.
Then let's talk about Timothy and how do we make sense of this strange passage?
Yeah. Well, it is this clear directive that Paul gives for women to teach or lead men with a rationale coming from Genesis 2. And so how do we square this with the rest of what's happening? And again, we get to this idea, we can say one trumps the other or this one trumps the others. And really, there are really smart Jesus-loving scholars who would say this one actually frames the rest of what the New Testament says. And so like
this one is the cornerstone.
This is the cornerstone. There are scholars who do that. You know, it would shape how we would understand, you know, prophecy, deaconesses, apostles.
Is that because it's a Genesis turn? It's like he's grounding it in something more fundamental.
Yeah. Part of it is the Genesis turn. And part of it, I think, is just actually the clarity at which he speaks right here, as opposed to some of the others, which seem to be a little bit, maybe feel a little bit more indirect.
Yeah.
And maybe more background, or you could say, you know, that was just specific. This is more timeless. I think there's problems with doing that because we end up putting artificial boundaries up all over the place that women can only teach men privately then, you know, this is about public teaching. And so, you know, we got to split hairs there or women can lead and teach boys, but not men. And then that always begs the question, well, boys and men back then in terms of chronology or men and boys now in the chronology. I just think you used to end up creating these artificial boundaries of what's happening. And that's why I think the better approach is actually to have these other passages kind of form the mosaic to inform us what Paul meant by teaching and having authority here. Hmm. That Paul doesn't mean broadly, you know, teaching and broadly having authority because of all these other examples that we have of women doing both. And again, there are super smart, you know, Jesus-loving scholars who've taken the scriptures seriously, who study this more broadly than we all have the time to do, and that's the tack that they take. And I tend to follow in this line. So there's a couple of different options on the table for us in 1 Timothy 2 and what's actually happening. Some scholars think that he's speaking to a specific heresy that's actually happening in Ephesus. That's who Paul's writing to Timothy,
who's
overseeing Ephesus. And there was fervent goddess worship in Ephesus at the time of
Artemis.
Yeah, Acts 19.
Great is Artemis of the Ephesians.
That's right, that's right. And all that rioting that happened because of that, right? And this was just an environment ripe for heresy. And it's actually heresy that we have historical evidence of that's centered on Eve as being the source of life, or like Mother Earth kind of an idea, where women were asserting their superiority, not just their equality, but their superiority. And they were encouraged to use sex for power, and to stay single and childless as an ideal. And that could be the heresy that Paul is mentioning here. I mean, in chapter one, actually, it fits with what Paul is saying, right? He talks about heresy back in chapter one. And it fits some of the problems that he actually is trying to address here in these letters. You know, that there are women who are busybodies and widows and how they conduct themselves. Yeah. So this whole Ephesians seem to have some problems with this. And so it could be that he's addressing this heresy and he's excluding women from teaching and domineering because of this particular problem with heresy.
Yeah, I remember when we were talking about Ephesians for the podcast earlier in the year, or maybe it was Timothy. And we were talking about Timothy in the podcast earlier in the year. We were talking about that passage where he's sort of distinguishing between widows.
Yeah.
I think in 1 Timothy 4.
Yeah.
And it seems like he's like, yeah, care for these widows who are older and right. are sort of living faithfully. Let's kind of be wise and prudent and not, you know, right. give our unbridled attention and affection to these other widows who are sort of They're busybodies that seem to be using, yes, exactly what you said, sort of sex for power. They're kind of going from man to man, and they're almost using the status as a means of power, I guess. And so I wonder, yeah, that kind of makes sense that it's all sort of fitting in this constellation of ideas that maybe there seems like there's problems with the men and what he's talking about with Timothy. They're quarreling and they're disagreeing over these stupid ideas, and they're turning it into these little like strange theological debates as opposed to the core foundation of what things are about. And then the women have been living into this different sort of sinful way.
Yeah, claiming superiority. That could very well be happening. That's one legitimate understanding and reading of this passage, really. The second option is that Paul is actually not talking about men and women generally. Huh. He's talking about husbands and wives. In verses 8 to 15, he talks about men and women. And in the Greek, when you use the terms for men and women, when you use them close to one another, they mean husbands and wives.
Yeah.
And so he could very well be giving instructions about marriage. And we say, well, that's some weird marriage advice there that Paul's giving. And then, you know, if we flip our Bible to 1 Peter 3, verses 1 to 7, many of the same concerns that Paul brings up here about what would be husbands and wives are the same concerns that Peter raises in 1 Peter 3.
Yeah.
And so it's not out of the norm or out of the imagination that things happen. And really, in the Greek, this is an option. This could be talking more about marriage than about men and women generally.
Yeah, which is not the conversation we're having today, but it's the conversation Bronwyn and I will be having next week, is gender roles in marriage and relationships. So like, and it feels like there are two sort of regressive seeming strains in the biblical text about women. And one of them is their role in the church and one of them is their role in marriage. And so we'll have that conversation next week. So,
I'm going to leave that to Bronwyn
deal with that.
My point is that maybe this isn't, is that some scholars would say that this is actually talking about husbands and wives and not men and women in general. He's not trying to make a de facto statement about men and women in the church.
In the church.
Right.
It seems like some things we've said are to help us sort of deal with the harshness of these texts. Like, okay, well, if we zoom out and we look at the bigger picture of the New Testament, like we did at the beginning of this conversation, that there is, I don't want to say wiggle room.
Trying to find loopholes or something.
Yeah. That's not really what we're saying.
No.
But yeah, if you were to isolate these regressive texts, it would seem pretty clear the directives for women in the church for all time. But if you zoom out, it becomes much less clear about what the early church is modeling for us, what the scriptures want us to do.
Yeah, and there's actually another option on the table for 1 Timothy 2. The last option is that Paul is not actually talking about two areas, you know, one being teaching and one having authority, that it's actually authoritative teaching or teaching authoritatively, like the ultimate protection of doctrine within the church. And that actually has legitimacy because Paul has been linking two words to create one idea throughout 1 Timothy. And let me just give a list here. He does it in verse 1, the first part of verse 2, second part of verse 2, verse 3, verse 4, verse 7a, verse 7b, 8, 9, and 11. So he's doing it throughout this whole section of taking two words to define one thing. And so it could be that he's actually talking about teaching authoritatively or authoritative teaching, this ultimate one being the protection of doctrine.
So what are you saying there?
That would be the equivalent of like a first century elder.
I see. So that's where someone might, which is where FBC is right now, where it's that there's women can be pastors and preachers, but not elders.
Right. Right. That's where the line would draw. And you have to ask yourself, I mean, and this is a discussion for another time, but right. what does a first century elder do and look like and function as yeah. opposed to a modern day elder? Because there are differences.
Right. Well, it's interesting too. And this is maybe not wise to just raise questions and not talk about them, but it's also like, is that the role of the elders at this church?
Yeah. Good
you know,
question.
Are the elders at this church being the ones shaping the ultimate teaching?
Or protecting the doctrine.
Or protecting, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Good question.
Yeah. No, because that's why it feels like certainly the knock on the egalitarian view, meaning the equal in all things view, is yeah. that you're adding things to the clear text to make them say what you want them to say. You're doing right. some hermeneutical gymnastics. You're doing things to make the text say something that's more palatable to you. You can see how that critique, because what we did, right? We
right.
read the text and we're like, okay, right. well, we got to zoom out. We got to get right. in more data, because obviously this data doesn't right. help the case. But it always does strike me that the complementarian view of equal in value but different in role.
Yeah.
There's also gray area that people are leaning into. And even like you were talking about, okay, so women can teach Sunday school, women can teach the youth, women can right. teach in college, but they can't teach right. at the church, you know?
And that's a form of complementarians. It's not all right. complementarians.
No. Yeah. This is just, yeah. you know, things you come across.
Yeah.
And so it's like, we're all in some way doing some sort of wrestling with what this must yeah. mean in this context,
yeah.
right? It's not just the egalitarians who are trying to figure out like,
right.
Well, and people aren't wearing head coverings,
right,
too, in our
right.
in our church.
Well, in all of that, if I could encourage anything, is that no matter what position we adopt, mm-hmm. we have to hold it with humility.
Yeah.
And that is, and by holding the humility, it doesn't mean that you don't have convictions. It just means this understanding that you could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we've been talking, I mean, whatever side you fall on, whatever gray areas, it isn't completely clear. We believe that there's one meaning because God wrote all of this. And so there does have to somehow fit together, even if we don't know how it does. And so we have to have a degree of humility, not just before God in terms of not knowing everything, but also with one another, that if someone has a different opinion or a different take on women in ministry, it really is an occasion for us to listen and ask, you know, do you see something that I don't see?
Right.
Do you understand something that I don't understand? Because listen, I've been studying this for 20 years. I planted a church and we had to come up with functional decisions about mm-hmm. women in ministry. We did women in ministry again here at FBC. And I've changed over the years just because as I've learned and grown, and it's not because the culture has been shaping me. I think it's more that the scriptures and my community of faith have helped me to read the scriptures better
mm-hmm.
and apply them better.
Yeah.
So I think there's just a degree of humility and being a learner in
yeah.
this and not the master.
Yes. And I love the idea of being convicted and holding it with open hands. Cause I just think that's just the posture we must take,
yeah.
you know, cause we've been wrong. Like the church
yeah.
has been wrong before about things. And
yeah.
I feel like you're able to say, I don't think I'm wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I've done yeah. the work. I've looked at it. I see the failure modes and this
yeah.
is what I think is best, but I'm going to hold it open-handedly because I can see how a faithful Christian could come to a different perspective.
Well, and not just that. I mean, no matter how we come out on this women in ministry issue, we should always be asking ourselves, am I being too permissive? Am I being too restrictive?
Mm-hmm.
That should bug us a little bit.
Yeah.
Because if we've got it sewn up, we haven't read the scriptures closely enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what's definitely clear to me is that like, if you were to go to the scriptures and say, I want to come out with a purely egalitarian reading of these scriptures.
Yeah.
You're just going to have to ignore stuff.
Yeah.
You know? And if you say, I want to go to the scriptures and come with a pure complementarian
yeah.
read of the scripture, it's like, you're just going to ignore stuff. You're going to have
yeah.
to. And so it's like neither side of this, again, sort of unfortunately binary debate is not going to be the one that gets to be the ultimate biblicist.
Nope.
You know, there's arguments on both sides.
Yeah.
And so I guess I want to try out an argument that I can see the downside of, but also it tends to continue to compel me.
Mm.
And I'm sure, you know, you've come across it, but just for our listeners, I think that like technical phrase is like a trajectory hermeneutic.
Yeah.
And
a redemptive hermeneutic is the other.
Okay.
Term.
Yeah. And the idea in this case is that Paul, and we've talked about it already, that he's recognizing the patriarchy of the
yeah.
particular cities he's in.
Yeah.
And he sees the breadcrumbs. And I can, even as I'm talking, it's like I can see someone poking holes in this, but I'll just try
yeah.
to talk about it. But he sees the breadcrumbs of where this story's going. You
right.
know, which you could say Galatians 3:28 is that kind of thesis, is
right.
that there is no distinction in terms of value and status
right.
in the kingdom between Jew, Greek, slave, free,
right.
male, female. And even he's living into the freedom that will ultimately, that's like the logic of the story. It's
yeah.
like women should be able to be teachers of this,
right?
And should be leading too, because we see it. We see them gifted, and you know, in Acts 2, like they have the gifts and all that stuff. So what he's doing is what I mentioned in Timothy, where he seems concerned about how the church is being viewed, and he seems concerned about how the watching world is viewing the church, and concerned in a way that's almost just pastoral.
Yeah,
you know, that it's like, hey, if we care about this message, we care about this little fledgling movement that's happening on the underside of power in a powerful empire. We care about this thing surviving.
Yeah.
It's just not wise and it's not prudent to like live fully into where the story is going to go right now. Right now, it might make sense to limit our freedom, to live into the patriarchy a little bit and subvert it in other ways, but live into it a little bit so as not to radically offend the people we are witnessing to.
Yeah.
And trust that the breadcrumbs will lead us eventually to when the cultural attitude towards these issues fits more in line with where the kingdom is headed.
Right.
Then we don't have to hold on to the patriarchy anymore.
Right.
We
can
actually loose ourselves from that. But for the time being, you know, we are going to get crushed if we live fully into the freedom that we're allowed, you know? It sort of makes sense of what even the Jesus question.
Yeah.
You know, like Jesus plopped these breadcrumbs of like he's bringing women closer. He's allowing them to speak these really important truths. And if you just look at the logic of Luke Acts in general, it's like Acts is a continuation of the gospel story. It's not that like we got everything we needed for the rest of life from Jesus in his ministry. We needed to watch this play out. And so there's sort of a logic of like we are continuing the story and it's going to be molding and shaping as we go. And so I can see where the critique would be, well, you're just totally, if you follow that, you're just totally at the whim of whatever culture wants. You know, it's just like whatever fits with culture and is best for culture, that's what you should say. But it's not necessarily that because there are these other texts.
Well,
I mean,
this is probably way beyond the scope of what we're talking about,
right,
but now we're here. So,
but
there is this idea of redemptive hermeneutic. I mean, it is. I mean, there's years ago, and I don't want to go way off the rails on all this stuff, but a guy wrote a book. And it was widely
panned.
It was called Slaves, Women, and Homosexuals. And so that kind of became kind of a flagship for these ideas. Because when it comes to slavery, there very much was a redemptive hermeneutic.
Right.
Because the breadcrumbs, the subversion was already there. I mean, read the book of Philemon if we don't think that that Paul had in mind the end of slavery. Mm-hmm. You know, 1 Corinthians, where he says, you know, buy back your freedom if you can. I mean, it's, slavery was not an ideal, even as an indentured servant in that day, less like the chattel slavery that we are more familiar with. So that redemptive hermeneutic is there.
Right.
And he gave frame of its limits and its potentials of when it was appropriate and when it was not appropriate. And then talked about, you know, could this be in women? And he did not definitively, I think he did definitively come down on what it might look like, but it's so nuanced. And
I think the issue is it univocal, right, in the scriptures? Is it univocal and do we tend to see the trajectory opening or closing? Like, is the trajectory getting wider, you know?
Or do we see paradigm busters, you know, like Phoebe and Junia, are they paradigm busters? And there's many other women in the New Testament. Are they paradigm busters of this kind of patriarchy or not? So you look for paradigm busters, you look for trajectory, you look for a lot of different.
Right. Which is certainly uneasy ground. Like it's certainly not like a look at the text, have that prove your case. It's certainly like you got to do more taking in other data or not necessarily other data, biblical data, but like in a way that's not strictly, again, like just proof texting.
Yeah.
It's like thinking about the story of the scripture, thinking about the narrative, thinking about the scope of it, and thinking about where's the story going?
Right.
What has been the shape? What are the breadcrumbs along the way? And which is that at the very least is like ripe for people disagreeing on what those sort of clues would say. So,
and again, that's why I just come back to this
humility.
Idea of humility, really. I mean, just
right.
And if we don't have a little bit of fear in us of, you know, gosh, Lord, I'm being too permissive. Gosh, Lord, I'm being too restrictive. Then we really haven't wrestled with the text well enough, or there's other texts that we need to wrestle with.
Right.
And that's, I mean, because to be honest, I mean, I feel that.
Yeah.
I feel that tension. It's like, gosh, am I too restrictive? Gosh, am I too permissive? Gosh, am I? And it's not like it keeps me up at night all the time, only when we have to make decisions about
it. Right, right, right.
But it is there.
Yeah.
It is there.
Yeah.
And I think that's the right attitude, but maybe that's just because I have it instead of commending it.
Well, because I think what the trajectory hermeneutic or redemptive hermeneutic, it's like, it feels like the right answer at the end of that, if that's true, if there's like, there's this redemptive arc towards some of these things where it's like, it starts pretty unpalatable, but like the logic of the faith is that, and the logic of the story is that it's leading itself to like sort of where we are as a culture now almost. Then if, and part of what Paul's doing is saying, hey, let's be smart about what we're forcing the watching world to deal with. You know, it's like, this is such a radical shift for them who lived in such patriarchy. So it makes sense to live into a subverted patriarchy a little bit now. Right. But then it seems like to take that story faithfully into today, it feels like it would be the equal and opposite mistake to continue with even a light patriarchy, because it's so unpalatable to our culture.
Right.
You know,
right.
If part of the issue for Paul was gospel accommodation, like hoping that the gospel would be in a context enough that it could flourish.
Yeah.
Then it feels like the most palatable way to do Christianity now would be a more equal way, you know? But you just said something that I kind of want to dive more into. You said that like, you feel this. And that's one reason, you know, I think we actually talked more about the text than I was anticipating, which is fun to do. But you, to be honest, have to sit with this and live with this in a way that others don't. You know, you had to you had to lead a church through changing the policy and changing the attitude on these things. And I guess I'm just curious what that was like, maybe on a broad scale, and then maybe we could dive more deeply into it. But I'm also curious, like, what made you think that you wanted to sort of pick this battle, so to speak? Because it really does feel, on from like my vantage point, or anyone who's not a senior pastor making these decisions, like, it's easy to have the theology. It's easy to think, I think this is what the text is saying.
Yeah.
And then it's another thing to actually put it in place and make changes. So it'd be fun to sort of reflect on that if you're willing.
Yeah. I mean, what made me want to go through this process? I mean, I would just say it was daunting. And I never felt great about doing it, to be honest. I even tried to avoid it for the first few years I was here, just because I was just trying to get established. I mean, I've only been at First Baptist now 5 years, which is not all that long when it comes to pastoral trajectories. And I knew it was going to be a thorny issue if we were going to dive into it. But I think a little bit more deeply, just within my own heart and soul, is that I was compelled by what this church needed and what God was calling us, because of what I saw and what I heard, what many women expressed here at FBC, that this felt more and more, when we were approaching it, like this was something we had to do. And I would say, even a little bit more personally, that I was compelled because I believed we were too restrictive.
Yeah.
I thought it was too restrictive. And I really wanted to be a part of empowering women and elevating them in leading and teaching, not just for the women's sake, but actually for the church's sake. Because, you know, we talked about that vision in Acts 2. And by doing this, could we showcase the Spirit? Mm-hmm. Could we really witness to the radical kingship of Jesus by doing this? And so that was more of what compelled me to do it. It was kind of the problems, it was the possibilities. It was my own kind of convictions in it. And then as well, it also, what encouraged me to do it was, I was convinced that the elders and the staff, that we would study, we'd process, and that we could move together actually in doing this. If I thought that I didn't have a team with me to do this, and that we, that as the leadership, we couldn't move in lockstep with one another or work it out with one another, I would have never done it. And so that's partly why I waited as long as I did, because I want to make sure that we were in a relational spot as elders and staff, and had some things in place of emotional health and how we did discernment together before we even ventured in it. Because it was not going to be me kind of leading the charge and being the tip of the spear kind of a thing. That was not how this church was going to move forward.
Yeah.
We were going to move forward if we were going to move all of the leaders forward in doing it. So, yeah.
I don't know what it is in me. It might be because I'm still on the younger side of things, which you are too, and you're not old. You're not an old man, but just like,
I'm older.
On the younger side of pastoral ministry, and maybe I've been in a ministry context that, you know, it's a 4-year cycle, so you can just change more quickly. It sort of just like bugs me that if you feel convinced of something, you know, and if you feel like it's, and humbly convinced, you know,
right.
But if you feel like this is what the scripture is saying, this is like the church I'm leading is not reflecting this.
Yeah,
it bugs me to think that you can't just change it. I can see the flip side of that. You don't want to be like a despot. You know, you don't want to just come in and say my way or the highway. You know, there's checks and balances. The elders keep you in check.
Yeah.
But it feels like a shame to me to think that there's a theological conviction you have that can't be realized because like the church can't handle it or something like that.
Well, the church, I mean, we were able to do the women in ministry so they could handle my convictions, right?
Yeah.
So it's not, it's just not immediate. It's a process.
Right.
And I guess I'd say a couple of things. I think of, you know, this church was here before I was even born.
Yeah.
Right. This church is like 75 years old and stuff. So this is a long-standing community of faith with mm-hmm. deep roots and deep ties into Davis and with one another, and has a certain way of doing it and a certain way of following Jesus.
Yeah. You
know? And I want to respect that, because there's a lot of ways that God has used that. The other part is, it's just, you got to be patient.
Yeah.
I mean, there is one thing to have conviction. There's another thing to help others feel that same conviction
mm-hmm.
and being in relationship with them. Because, you know, I could be wrong, and it may be not right for this environment exactly particularly the way I see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really happy to collaborate and be in teams with one another. Because really, as I look at the ownership of the church, it's not my church. This is Jesus' church.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to work in a team and a community of people to move this forward.
What do you think would have happened if, you know, in all the elder study and pastor study, if the voices were going in the direction that you didn't think?
Yeah, I mean, there's always that danger, right? There's always that danger when you get into the room and you start really studying the scriptures.
Right, which is the humility piece. It's like you come in with what you think.
Yeah.
And then you are open to being wrong. But like, what if you get more convinced about what you think, and yet the trajectory of what everyone else is seeing the scriptures is the other way, and now you're in a position where you opened up this process, maybe hoping that it goes the direction you're convicted in, and now it's going the other way. I guess that's when the rubber might meet the road a little bit.
I'm really convinced that God and His Spirit can bring us to a unity of it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that all the elders thought the exact same things that I did,
mm-hmm.
but we were able to move forward in such a way mm-hmm. together in lockstep and doing that. And I'm just really confident in God and the scriptures.
Yeah.
But this particular issue, I've studied for like 20 years, like I said. I'm really confident of the scriptures being able to speak to us and lead us and teach us and shape where we're going.
Yeah.
And so I'm not so concerned about getting my agenda through as much as I am about getting the scriptures through us.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if that takes time, then that takes time. If we need to sit and process and think about it longer than need be, then so be it.
Yeah.
But,
right.
I mean, we want the instantaneous fix and change, but we're more like, you know, farmers or something like that. We kind of have to let the plant grow and kind of tend to the vine and shape and mold and form as we can.
Yeah. So. I can imagine too. You know, you go through this process, you feel like you're doing it right, you feel like you're being patient and feel like you're letting the scriptures speak, and then you lay it out there. You know, you say this is the direction we feel convicted in, and this is where, you know, we've done the study, we've done everything, and then people are gonna respond, right? Like what did you hear from people? What was it like for you? And I really am interested in this. Like, it's one thing to have the ideas, it's another thing to tell them to people in a way that's saying, hey, we're changing some things and opening yourself up to this. I'm just curious to know what it looks like to be at the helm of something like that. What did you hear from people?
Yeah, there was a wide range of responses, but kind of a bigger picture is that it was much more emotionally based than it was about what the Bible says. And that's not, and when I say that, I want to be really careful. It's not because people did not care what the Bible said.
Yeah.
That is not what I'm saying. It's because most of these issues, when we get into women in ministry, and even as we're talking and people are listening in, we have a deeply emotional tie to this thing of our identity, of the identity of the church, the way God works, and really what all of this says to all of our beloved pastors and leaders that have built into us and made us kind of the person that we are, that God's used. And so it just became very, very emotional very, very quickly. And I knew it was going to be emotional. I didn't realize the depth of emotions. I mean, I knew it was going to be emotional, right? I don't think I appreciated the degree that it actually was. And so some were really angry because they feel like a betrayal. It was a betrayal of kind of their sense of how we were to be different than the world operates and their sense of what other beloved mentors had taught them and modeled for them.
Yeah.
And so they felt very betrayed. Some were sad because they were grieving kind of a loss in this of like, I thought I understand the scriptures. I thought I knew what this thing was. I thought everything else in this world is changing. Can my church not change because I can count on it?
Yeah, yeah.
Some were just overjoyed that we would just bravely go into the scriptures and just say, you know, what is it saying? And learn and let's change together. You know, they were overjoyed. And some were frustrated that we didn't change enough or quickly enough.
Right.
Again, it's understandable that people were shaken. And so all of it, again, it forced me to slow down and to really listen to what they were saying and to really hear what they were coming from. and help them live into that change.
Yeah.
And what it looked like. So whenever we think these things are purely an informational kind of decision, we right. make a huge mistake, because this is right. even the fact that we're having this conversation means that it's a much more emotional issue than we like to give it credit for.
Yeah.
And we have a vested emotional interest in a particular way that this comes out, not just a Bible curiosity
right.
about it.
Yeah, we're not all just scholars in the room. It's like it's over and over again, you come across this very true idea that we are more than brains on a stick. Like we are full people.
Yeah.
And so all these things are hitting us and connecting with us on more than just our intellect.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I feel like I was part of that, you know, I was part of the emotional reaction. I remember, you know, I was in a sort of an interesting place in this process when we were going through it, because I was on staff. So like I was in the staff meetings hearing updates, but I wasn't in on the conversations about the change. Like I wasn't in on the, actually my wife was in the reading group in some of the early stages of like, let's read books and think about it. So Katie was in on that, but I was sort of on the outside looking in, but also sort of on the inside looking out. And so I was in this weird position, but I felt more like a parishioner. I felt like I was more like getting the updates as the church was. And I remember being frustrated. Like I remember my particular frustration was, it just felt like we weren't confident, and maybe even to put it as like, felt like you weren't confident enough for me in what I was wanting from you. And precisely because it's like, I agreed with sort of where we were going. So I'm like, we need to like this. We need to say, if we're going to go this way, we need to be convinced and convicted and go confidently in that direction.
Yeah.
And as we're talking, I'm sort of realizing how, gosh, you must've been getting all that stuff from all over the place of just no one was probably totally satisfied with you.
Yeah.
But how was it personally? Like, and I guess we've already talked about it, but like how was it dealing with some of that critique and what did it do for you? And you were in a very unique chair. And I guess I'm just curious to know what it's like to be in the chair.
Yeah, I mean, so one, you're thinking, okay, as we're processing, I'm thinking, okay, where are the staff at this? Where are the elders with this? Where's the church at this? I'm thinking at multiple levels and multiple relationships. And so sometimes it was tough to just be confident, because I'm trying to really not represent just me, but represent a larger crew than me. And that's always, to be honest, that feels daunting to me. That always feels like that. To speak for other people in a way that's fair to them feels like a lot of pressure for me.
Yeah.
Actually.
Oh yeah.
And so that's part of it. But I would say just the private conversations I had and the strong emotions that were brought before me, it just makes you question yourself. It makes you question the process. It makes you question the scriptures again. You know, I just kept always wondering, you know, like, what are you seeing in the scriptures and in this situation that I'm not seeing? Am I blind to something? Am I misreading something? And so every time these kind of strong emotional reactions came, I always had to kind of go back and re-decide this issue. Isn't that odd? I mean, it wasn't just decide and go. It was decide, re-decide, re-decide, re-decide all the way through it to make sure that I wasn't crazy.
Did your conviction get stronger through having to re-decide? Because you can imagine sort of like with anything, repetition might implant it all the more. Or did it get weaker as indecision kept having to creep up too?
I would say the scriptures got clearer because I had to stake on it. Yeah. And I would say even the relational ties that I had to people strengthened, and that made it easier. That's a tough one to answer. It was both the scriptures, it was both the conviction. It just became more and more clear that this is absolutely positively right.
Yeah.
Because the scriptures say so. Even though there's these different emotional reactions going on, I keep coming back to, we need to let women be pastors.
Yeah.
There's nothing in our structure, in our system, there's nothing in the scriptures that should be excluding women from this position to preach and pastor. So I became more and more convinced of that.
Yeah. As we're talking, I'm realizing, like, I think what I wanted you to be was so confident that you didn't care what people were saying about you or about the church, which is sort of dehumanizing, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, you shouldn't feel the emotions that people are, the strong emotions people are sending your way, because you know, you're a leader, or you're bearing the weight of the truth of the scripture. I don't know. It's like there's some way of like, I wasn't really allowing you in sort of, like I said, my critique of like, hey, just be confident and go through this, like, wasn't allowing you the space to mourn or the space to be hurt, or I don't know.
Yeah. No. I mean, it, you know, it, because the reality is that some had to walk away from FBC. And I'm casting no shame on that because of how important this issue was to them. And it broke my heart because I wanted them to embrace this permission because I saw the real I still see the real possibilities of it in mm-hmm. terms of evidence of the Spirit and Jesus being king and mm-hmm. people being mobilized for the kingdom. And so I really saw the possibilities. And so it broke my heart that they didn't want to embrace that same thing. And always, you know, I mean, church operates more like a family. And so it feels like losing a family member when someone's upset in your family, it kind of disrupts the whole house, mm-hmm. right? I mean, when Mason's upset, you know, you and Katie are understandably upset. It's yeah. kind of, there's kind of an analogy that happens here. Because I think of people here, you know, I treat them more like family than I do like a client mm-hmm. or a pawn in my vision of what needs to be accomplished. I see that I think that I'm more like a shepherd that, you know, we're trying to move this whole place and this whole community forward to be kingdom advancers and yeah. agents of the kingdom. So, right. yeah, I mean, it was hard to hear those extreme reactions because I had my own mourning going on. And every time you had to check yourself and say, okay, am I not crazy here? No, this is what the scripture said. We need to be yeah. more permissive, you know, I mean, so.
Sarah, this might be okay. asking too much, but like any part of you that thinks like the leaving process just feels like, I guess I could imagine myself saying like, this is what's wrong with modern church. And this is like way, I'm speaking way too generally now.
Yeah,
it's like
yeah.
sort of irresponsible. But like, what if we were to stay together and work through this and disagree, yeah. you know, like, wouldn't that be a better model? Wouldn't that be a better yeah. image of what yeah. the church is? You know, I think about Romans 14 yeah. talking about like, you know, yeah, yeah. sure, eat kosher, yeah. do the Sabbath laws, yeah. you know, but do that or don't do that. But whatever you do, do it to the glory of God and don't make this a primary issue yeah. when Jesus is the primary issue. And it's like, man, this like splintering that happens when we disagree theologically on something. On one hand, it makes sense. You just kind of maybe want to worship yeah. in a way that feels right to you and true to you, but
right, yeah. Well, and that's not everyone. There were some that left. There was a lot. I mean, like I said, there was some that were frustrated that we didn't move fast enough, we didn't change enough, and they're still here. So, there's people
yeah.
right now. There are people who've hung in here and called this their family, and they're going to move forward. They believe in the leadership. They believe in me. They believe in the staff, and so they're here and they're a part of the ministry. And they disagree with the decision. Some think that we didn't go far enough. Some thought we went too far, but yeah. they're hanging here and they're hanging together as a family. So while there were some who left, there was a lot who actually stayed and said, you know what? I'm not going to leave over this.
Yeah.
And in some ways, some of the people who stayed behind, who stayed in this family, they lost friends out of
right.
their home group. They lost, you know, people that they've been going to church with for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them, but, you know, some of them.
Yeah.
So they're to be commended, actually, because they stuck around, and I think they're benefiting from it.
They are to be commended. It's almost like, I wish that we could almost, like, tell those stories.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like,
yeah.
like, this is the level of faithfulness
yeah.
that I don't feel like we often, I don't know if it's that we don't call people to, but we don't highlight it, because obviously, you don't want to just say, these people disagree or these people agree with me.
Right.
You know, it's sort of unpalatable to out people, I guess, in terms of that. But it's like, I do feel like that's countercultural.
It is.
And
I know who they are, and they've spoken to me privately, and I've just kind of given kudos in every way that I possibly could.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
that's an ecclesiology that I want our students to have, is
yeah.
like, you might be in a church that is disappointing to you,
yeah.
both in maybe its preaching is not what you want it to be, you
yeah.
know, or they have a different view on women in ministry or
yeah,
whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would just love for you to
yes.
stick with it. I'd love for you to love that church. I'd love for you to see it as family. I'd love for you to
yeah.
to talk to the senior pastor. I don't know.
I
those are the people I want our students to become in 20 years.
Yeah, you know? I agree. I think that is the way church should be done. Because, I mean, if we have a monolith of everyone who agrees, we will lose the strength of diversity. I really think that. I mean, the body is a body and
right.
has different gifts, different strengths, different opinions. But that diversity actually is a mark of the Spirit that, you know, Democrats and Republicans can be arm in arm
yeah.
under the banner of Jesus.
Right.
Where else does that happen in our culture?
Yeah.
The answer is nowhere.
right.
Right. I mean, as we've seen recently, and not to get too political here or anything
right.
like that, but, you know, but that kind of diversity, I think it actually strengthens us. I don't think it weakens us.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love for, you know, college students to get into the local church and just dig in and just love the church and
mm-hmm.
love the people, become a part of the family, appreciate the older generation because they've been there for decades
mm-hmm.
and they see and know stuff about Jesus and about the church that we couldn't possibly. I still am learning from some of the older generation here, and they are remarkable in terms of what they don't tell you that they're actually doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I learn of older women who are, you know, we would look at and they might be frail and they are actually serving in ways that, you know, driving some of their friends around to doctor's appointments and things like that, that no one knows about except for these few people. So yeah, I would love for that. But I do understand when it came to this women in ministry issue that this was a deal breaker for some. And I think we got to figure out, you know, what are the deal breakers when it comes to church? I personally don't think women in ministry is a deal breaker, but I certainly understand if some would hold to that.
Yeah. And I agree. It's like, if I were to have conversations with the folks who left, maybe I might have encouraged them to stay, you know, but would have blessed them as they go, you know?
Yeah. And to be honest, I mean, for some of them, it was the best thing for them to actually leave.
Yeah.
Because if they were to have stayed, I think they would have been breaking covenant and community in other ways, in ways that would have been destructive to for us moving forward as a kingdom. And that's just part of us dealing with us and our frustration and our anger and stuff like that. I think they would have hurt themselves. I think they would have hurt the church. And I think it was probably the right thing for them to go. And it doesn't mean, I still see them around. I still speak well of them. You know.
Do you feel like there's anything you would have done differently, you know, with some hindsight? Anything in this, the whole transition that you would have done differently?
So when I first interviewed, I wished I would have said something to the elders because I knew this was going to be an issue. Mm-hmm. I just had my antenna up. And it's not because of FBC. It's just the nature of church. I wish I would have said something like, you know, I'm happy where we are right now with women in ministry, but I want you to know this comes up every 5 years, no matter what your stance of what the ministry is, and we're going to have to deal with it. I wish I would have kind of given them an alert to that. It's not that I avoided it or anything like that, but you know, in interview context, you never know kind of like what to be able to share and what not to share. But the reality is that women in ministry comes up every 5 years.
Yeah.
In every context I've gone in, it comes up every 5 years.
I remember
some level at some juncture.
I remember reading in Glenn Stassen and David Gushy's book, Kingdom Ethics, you know, they mentioned that like every generation has their thing. They're like big hot topic. And it seemed like in like the 80s and 90s, it was women in ministry. But you're saying it still keeps coming up. It keeps rearing its head.
Yeah. And I think especially, I mean, and I'm just going to make a generalization. I think especially in Northern California, this tends to be a bigger issue here than it does in other parts of the country. And there's bigger other emotional issues that came up in Massachusetts or came up in New Jersey when I lived there.
Yeah.
That would not have come up here.
Right.
So yeah, I think women in ministry is one of those things
in
Northern California that is actually, and I think other churches are starting to discover that as well, because believe it or not, there's other churches who've reached out to me like, hey, how did you guys navigate this and talk about this? So they're having to deal with it and they're realizing it's far more emotional and difficult than they thought it would be.
So what else do you think, again, with some hindsight, what would you have maybe done differently?
So in that, I mean, some of this is preparation. Last preparation is that I knew it was going to be deeply emotional. I don't think I really appreciated how deeply it was going to be, and to try to prepare myself for that and, you know, the elders and staff for facing it, even knowing that it was an emotional issue. I think we didn't have an appreciation of how emotional it was going to be and how together we were going to have to be and how clear we were going to have to be with one another. You know, you're talking about some of that as a staff. I wish as a staff, I would have helped the staff a little bit more with like, we're going to, you know, these are going to be emotionally waves that we're going to have to like row our boat through here. And, you know, we want to be a team that's safe. We want to be a team that wants to express these emotions, and you guys got to help me present well, kind of a thing. And then I would say just with the higher emotions, whenever there's this emotional turmoil, I wish, like to your point, I wish I would have been more confident and reassured in leading us through it, kind of like a Moses figure, that kind of thing, charge the hill kind of thing. I wish I would have been more like that.
But is that at odds with the humility? Like, is that sort of like, do we really want both? Like, we don't want too confident of a leader.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like, hey, like listen to people.
Yeah.
But other times it's like, don't listen to people. Just like, if you're right, go for it, man.
Yeah.
So it's like, anyway, I'm aware. I only interrupt you to say that. So like, I'm aware of how I'm sure it could feel impossible.
Yeah. It does feel like the impossible task. But again, it's like, if I'm going to obey God, let's obey God, follow the scriptures and let him let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean to be a jerk about it.
Right.
It doesn't mean to just charge forward like a Moses figure. It also means humility and listening and things like that. And I think I honestly probably could have done a better job of just managing my emotional world during that time.
Yeah.
With the emotional storms, I would have done some of the things that I've now learned to do since then that I've put into place just because I have realized how important my emotional world is to me leading well, preaching well, being a good friend, being a good dad, being a good husband. And so, you know, I would put in some of those things. I would, you know, I wasn't seeing a counselor at the time, and now I'm seeing a counselor, you know, once a month to kind of check in with my emotional world and give me direction in terms of what I'm doing well, what I'm not doing well, processing some of the difficulties that I face, you know, especially in a pandemic. This is an emotionally turmoil time. And so, you know, this kind of life direction and life coaching is just needed for me right now. And so, I wish I would have done that. I wish I would have used journaling more. And sometimes when I think of journaling, it's like, oh, I've got to write this long entry. And, you know, it's got to be at the beginning of the day when my thoughts are fresh and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I wish I would have just kept the journal out on my desk and said, you know, this is thrilling. This is heartbreaking. And to help myself be more aware of what's going on, of my own emotional world and my response to this person, that person, this situation. I wish I would have just taken time to just not just seeing work as producing, but seeing this as part of the work to be able to pastor, lead, and teach and produce. Yeah. So I was not exercising on a regular basis then, and I wish I would have exercised even more. What I've learned is that I have to physically exert myself to match my emotional exertion. Mm. And if I don't, I can't rest well, I don't sleep well, I'm not able to work out some of these internal conflicts that are going on. So I have to exercise really hard to, especially in this emotional turmoil of a time.
Yeah.
I wish I would have had that in place. And I guess I wish I would have practiced greater just transparency with some trusted partners in ministry a little bit more than I did.
Yeah.
Kind of put myself out there a little bit more with people who could handle the truth.
Right.
And again, you know, I mean, it was not that long ago, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you go through the storm and you find out who you can and can't share yourself with, kind of a thing, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, those are some of the things that I would think of. I don't think I would change necessarily the process of how we did it or the decision of how we did it. I think I would want to change more of my self-awareness of me in that situation and how I could have managed that a little bit better to have been more effective for the staff, the church.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. Well, we've gone on and on. And, and so thanks for your transparency. Thanks for your wisdom on the text. And I'm realizing now that I didn't prep you for this, but do you know about Quarantine Corner?
I don't know about Quarantine Corner, but I'm happy to join in and jump in with both feet.
Quarantine Corner is America's favorite segment, and it's where we give a little recommendation for people to do during quarantine. It could be something that we watched, something that we ate, something just something interesting that's happened to us, and we give the people what we want. So I'll go first, and if you don't have one, then that's fine. But maybe as I'm going, you might think of just something that you can tell the people to do. And so I'm going to tell you. Yesterday, my YouTube algorithm busted out this video for me of Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig in a movie called The Skeleton Twins, which I've never seen, never really heard of. But they do this lip sync thing to the song "Nothing's Gonna Stop Us." Nothing's Gonna Stop Us by Speedwagon or something like that. Wait, who's it by? No, sorry, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now by Starship and
Jefferson Starship,
something like that. I don't know, but it. It like filled me with joy. It is hilarious and they are funny. And it feels like if you really don't want to experience anything inappropriate, skip the first 30 seconds and skip the last 30 seconds, but just go for the middle section. And the lip singing is hilarious. The dancing is hilarious. I feel like it's one of those things like I'm going to put in my back pocket. Like if I'm ever in just a crummy mood, it just makes me feel like human. It makes me feel like the joy of humanity. And so that's why if you're a member of College Life last night, I told Jess who manages our audio and all the Zoom stuff. I was like, I have a request for a song to bring people into, and it was Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now. And then we had all the technical difficulties from last week when it was like raining and windy and everything so we just played that for 10 minutes because we couldn't start the show. So anyway, that's I'll put the link in the show notes, but if you just want to look it up, man, Skeleton Twins, Bill Hader, Kristen Wiig, Nothing Gonna Stop Us Now. You're not gonna be disappointed. It's good stuff. So anyway, do you have a quarantine corner you can share with us?
Well, you know, I'm off the cuff here. I want to have something really cool to watch and stuff like that because we're all dying for something different to watch on our Netflix or Amazon Prime or Hulu, whatever or HBO Max or Disney Plus, whatever your choice of streaming is. The one that Jenny and I have really enjoyed is actually Community. We did not get on the Community bandwagon because I think I got it late and I didn't understand like what was going on and I wasn't, you know, captivated enough to try to figure it out. But when we started episode one, I think I've gone through like three seasons in about a month.
You're powering just, through. Yeah.
Just hysterical. And so for the college student, they seem like absolute classics for the community college and the college experience. And they're so creative with, Law and Order kind
of thing. Yeah, that's super meta. Big time meta. Yeah, Katie, we were watching it for a while. Katie doesn't do well without a pretty serialized storyline, like some things to be looking forward to in terms of like, you know, the overarching story. So so we gave up on it, but it's good. I watched it when I was in early college and it was good stuff. So
and honestly, it's great for a laugh. Yeah. I mean, because there's stuff that you can watch and read that's just so serious. And I need a comedy. And so Community is that for me.
Right. That's good stuff. Well, that's it for us. Thank you again, Steve, for taking us through that. And looking forward to hearing you on Tuesday.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
All right, that is it for the podcast. And I just want to say something explicitly here that I was hoping would be implicitly clear throughout the conversation. But, you know, sometimes getting a behind-the-scenes look at something can sort of burst our bubbles that we had in our mind. But what I'm hoping for and praying for is that this conversation has actually increased your love for the local church and increased your affection for the local church. And so, Steve, thank you for bringing us into your world. Thank you for reopening this process and letting us see through your eyes. And thank you for, you know, receiving a little critique from me with graciousness. And, of course, thanks for your wisdom. Thank you is also in order to, of course, Josh Paskey and Kyle Jung for the music of Your Pod and Your Staff. It is marvelous. And a big thank you to Mike Loretto this week, who had to deal with the fact that the power kept going off during this conversation. Zoom stopped multiple times, and we even had to change locations mid-recording. It was a mess, and he made it sound not that way. He is a real-life hero. And to close for now, College Life, you should know this, that we love you more than the total amount of time Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now has been stuck in my head for the past week, which is pretty dang close to 100%. We'll see you next week.